For some, that may not have.
Many would not have heard the tape, so.
Yeah.
I would say that would be in order.
This book is called The Lamentations of Jeremiah. And it is quite personal, the content. And we feel he was inspired in the writing of it, but it's mostly emotional. And it's written as a, not as a story coming to a climax, but a series of thoughts about particularly the destruction of the temple and the city of Jerusalem. And the format is structured in a way that normally would not be favorable to an emotional outburst, because it is very much along that order. So we have suggested that originally he had composed it in a writing form of his feelings, and then later, for the benefit of his people and succeeding generations, he put it in the form that we now find it, in a structured form. And chapters 1 and 2 are 22 verses each, and they correspond with what was then the letters of the Hebrew alphabet. And each verse in the first chapter started with Aleph, and then went right through the A, B, C, D of our alphabet. Of course, ours is 24 letters. The Hebrew was 22. So you'll notice that of the five books of Lamentations, four of them are 22 verses each. The middle chapter, chapter 3, is 66 verses, 3 times 22. So we can see it's highly structured. And this was done, this technique was done by the Hebrews. Matthew, a number of others had this thought in mind, even though Matthew did not write that way. He did think that way. And David, of course, 119th Psalm. And so chapter 1 would be A, B, C, D, E, F, as it were. Each verse would start with the successive letters of the Hebrew alphabet, and the same with the second chapter. And then the fifth chapter was different in that it was A, 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 B, 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 C, 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 D, 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 as it were. And it didn't matter what the letters were, as they had to start in that fashion, but the word might be a definite article, might be a verb, it might be a noun, whatever it is, but it would start with successive letters of the Hebrew alphabet. And so when we started with the first chapter, you'll notice that, I don't know about your Bible, but mine says, Jerusalem's misery for her sins. So the bulk of this chapter is Jeremiah's emotionally beholding Jerusalem, looking at Jerusalem and likening it to basically a woman, a city, but in the guise of a woman. In the next chapter, he views it from another perspective. In the third chapter, it's his own emotions, personal, that he gives. So we had, now we're up to verse 18. So we'll have a reading, and we'll start, Brother Brendan, then Sister Bernice, Brother Russell. Let us have a reading of two verses.
The Lord is righteous, for I have rebelled against his commandment. Hear, I pray you, all people, and behold my sorrow. My virgins and my young men are gone into captivity. I called for my lovers, but they deceived me. My priests and mine elders gave up the ghost in the city, while they sought their meat to relieve their souls.
All right, now when it says in verse 18, I have rebelled. I pray you all people. I call for my lovers, etc. Who's the I?
Jerusalem.
In a pictured as a city speaking. And it's given a personified character in this chapter. Now, verse 18 says, the Lord is righteous. And right away, this puts us in the right path, the right slant. For instance, let us take today, the Jews of the diaspora feel and have expressed in their writings down through history in the gospel age that their experience in the various countries in which they found themselves dispersed, they did not blame it on themselves. They blamed it on the Gentiles, that it was their fault. But we find that Jeremiah, Daniel, take it from the other perspective. We have sinned. The nation sinned. And that is the reason for their experience, their tribulation and sorrows. Now, when it states, Jehovah is righteous, for I have rebelled against his commandment. Any comment with regard to the latter half of this verse? Hear, I pray, you all people. Now notice the time sequence. What has happened, the city is empty. It's in ruins, both the city and the temple. But he's picturing it as though there's a woman there, sitting in the midst of this desolation. And that city, that woman is Jerusalem, or in other words, Zion, given the daughter of Israel, as it were, given various appellations. All right, now back here. Here I pray you, all people, behold my sorrow. My virgins, my young men, are gone into captivity. Yes.
Such a contrast from the first verse where it says, "Who was once great among the nations, who was a princess among them." So, from an exalted standpoint at one time to where she is now.
All right. And what you'll behold my sorrow, my virgins, my young men are gone into captivity. And it would show that the ones basically that were taken into captivity when the city was destroyed are the ones who followed Jeremiah's advice to get out before the city was destroyed. And that would take courage and to get out in time. And it was roughly the ones that did go out was about in the midpoint of the siege. So there were many, many months, but the last half of the siege period, which was almost not quite 2 years, in the midst of that period, before the famine set in and other things, the ones who obeyed Jeremiah fled the city and went over to the enemy. And didn't it say in an earlier chapter, Jeremiah said, if you do this, what I'm telling you, what the Lord told me, he told me to tell you that if you do this, you will not be put to death. I guarantee that. I'm putting it in my own words to make it brief. And those that obeyed Jeremiah were taken captive. and the spirit. Those that remained behind basically were destroyed in one fashion or another. Verse 19, I called for my lovers, but they deceived me. And who were the lovers that deceived Israel? This is before the destruction of the city in what many of us feel is 606 B.C. rather than 586.
Was that Syria and Egypt?
All right. What was the first one?
Syria.
And
Egypt.
And Egypt. Well, usually Israel would call on one of these two nations as an ally. This was done in Europe. This is done in warfare, in many, down through history, because Israel was a buffer state and was considered by many as not militarily of itself a threat to their own existence. So when you have a superpower on one side and one on the other side, the one that's in between usually uses that as a bargaining point. And they apprise the situation as to which one they think is going to be the victor in the war. So it's a guessing game. So when they make the decision, they usually think, well, this one's going to win. We might as well have a secret understanding with them. And so, and in this case, they expected Egypt to assist them in their resistance against Babylon, the Chaldaic power. All right. And then there were other smaller people who would be lovers, and these would be the ones related to Israel of the Semitic race. And we find that Ammon and Moab, they were related in a way. They were, of course, the nations, what was the daughters of Lot, that was involved. But historically speaking, when you go back in the lineage, they would feel that they would be assist them. But what happened? These lovers, Egypt the superpower, the other two powers that were brothers, as it were, in some respects, whether it was through the two that were involved. It was Esau was one that was involved. And the other was Ishmael. So what happened in their history after the flood, and you came down, Terah, Abraham, so forth down, and then Shem, and all the way down to Israel, you have this where even today the Arabs feel that the seed of promise was, instead of being Isaac, was Ishmael. And then so they claim the promises from that standpoint, where the Bible has it through Isaac, and in Isaac is the Messiah to come and the promises given. Then you had Abraham married Keturah, and he had several children after Isaac, and these were dispersed in, like in Arabia, and in the in-between areas of Ammon and Moab. So there were plenty that Israel would think would come to her aid, and no doubt they sent emissaries to these various nations for their cooperation and help, and found that they were cold with regard to that. Notice too that when Israel's worship was Ashtoreth, Molech, and these are the gods of these other peoples that are surrounding Israel. And so that shows how there was a intercourse, that's a decent word, not today, between the two nations, between these various nations, and so much so there was marriages that took place, as well as they even worshiped their gods. Now when they're in trouble, they're looking for help, and they find on all sides that when it came down to what we say vulgarly, brass tacks, they were non-existent. In fact, they even cheered the enemy. When Nebuchadnezzar, his army was destroying Israel, they were on the hilltops cooperating with the enemy and supporting the enemy. So the lovers, I called for my lovers, sent out these emissaries and so forth, looking for aid. I pray, and they deceived me. Now, my priests and my elders gave up the ghost in the city. That word ghost is of a relatively recent invention. I think the history, it started to enter into the text in the Elizabethan era, where it became a real part of the vocabulary instead of the word spirit. My priests and mine elders gave up the spirit in the city, and while they sought their meat to relieve their souls. And it is conjectural, but during the siege, everybody was to dispose of their capital, as it were, their food capital, to put it in a common heap for the benefit of the survival of the city. I conjecture that the priests were not asked to do that. They were excluded. They were separate from the state. So an ordinance was given. It isn't written here, but there was an ordinance that there was to be the wheat, the rye, the barley, was all to be, if you had any in the house, you didn't hoard it. If you did, you would have problems later, which some did. And they put it in a common heap, and then they each got their scoop of their daily rations, hoping then the city would outlast the siege of the enemy. But the priesthood did not give their food supply. And so they had plenty. Didn't they receive, as Levites, the people, when they brought things to the temple, when there were tithes that were given? So they had their larders full. And instead of commiserating with the civilian population, as it were, separate from the ecclesiastical echelon, they rather keep their goodies to themselves. Now, see, you won't read this in any of your dictionaries or commentaries, but I think that's a reasonable assumption based on the statement, because it says that the priests kept their meats, kept their supply, and we can see why they were excluded in military warfare. Even today, you have with those that are studying for the rabbinical, for the priesthood or whatever, to support the orthodoxy in Israel, they were excluded from the draft, the military draft, even today. So this is nothing unusual. Even Egypt, with various wars there, the same thing was done. All right, here we have then my priests and mine elders. And very often, who were the elders? My priests and my elders. Usually the elders are closely associated with the priesthood, and in later times it was usually called The Sanhedrin. And it was like a mixed bag there of the ones who would be elected in that Sanhedrin. Some of them would be priests. Some of them wouldn't be, but highly influential as teachers in one capacity or another. And so these, they feared for themselves instead of sacrificing for their subjects or for those that they ministered to. And so then in another way the priests had no spirit in themselves, because what would happen? When this enemy was outside, wouldn't they be looked to for advice? Advice what to do. And what kind of advice could they give? Because they did not, the Lord did not speak through them. So they were without, they had enough problems of their own to be a help or an aid to those that they were supposed to minister to. Yes.
Brother Frank, and that probably would have been very obvious because they hadn't listened to Jeremiah, the prophet of the Lord. And now, when the city was being sieged and he had given all this advice, they'd realized Jeremiah was the one who the Lord was using and not these priests.
Yeah. And then you had the prince, the king. He deserted the ship. He fled. And they took things with them. When they fled. So here, the ones who were leaders in various component parts of the state, there was no support. They were thinking of themselves and their survival rather than having, a patriotic spirit, the Lord's spirit of praying to God. This is your city, this is your temple, and we are being besieged by an enemy. And that was done one other time successfully. When was that?
Sennacherib.
Sennacherib. Hezekiah in that period. And what happened? In one day, the Lord slew the enemy. That's what they should have done in 606, and that's what they should do today. Israel. Their whole history is the God of Israel. So you can see how far things have developed. The same history is repeating itself. Go on.
One thing that astounds me is from our studies in Jeremiah that the Lord, even while the enemy was just about to break through the door, just before Zedekiah fled, he offered to do exactly that, basically, that if Jeremiah said to Zedekiah, if you'll surrender now, everything will be okay.
Yeah.
Everything will be forgiven, and Zedekiah couldn't do it. And then, I mean, that was right. They were encompassed. I mean, it was inevitable destruction, and he still couldn't.
Well, it shows that the Lord gave them every opportunity to obey him, and a way out gave all the way down the line, the king, the princes, and then he spoke to the people as well as all strata of the society were given advice by Jeremiah, and the higher echelon as a whole was like as it were a zero response. Now, let us read. Can we continue? Yes.
Just that one point. In Jeremiah, this is the same period described as the dearth, was it?
This is during the
dearth of Jerusalem?
The siege of Jerusalem. And basically, a great deal of the book is on that. But there are squibs of information that we can derive other information from, but what right now, where the situation is, here the city is devoid of occupants, and particularly the promising occupants, because the people who are old, well, they're due to die in a few years. So it's the young maidens and it's the young men that are the hope of Israel's future. And so she's sitting there, my virgins and my young men are gone from me. She is devoid of any population and sitting in the midst of ruins. This is a very dramatic picture. The whole thing. Jeremiah was a very unusual person, considered by some of the Jewish orthodoxy as perhaps the chief prophet of the Old Testament, even rivaling Moses. Back here, let us read 20 and 21. Next, please.
Behold, O Lord, for I am in distress. My bowels are troubled. My heart is turned within me. For I am grievously rebelled. Abroad the sword bereaveth at home. There is as death. They have heard that I sigh. There is none to comfort me. All my enemies have heard of my trouble. They are glad that thou hast done it. Thou wilt bring the day that thou hast called, and they shall be like unto me.
All right. This is written so exponentially, for want of a word. This is still Jerusalem talking. And it says, Behold, O Lord, Jerusalem praying. Yeah. Well, it said in an earlier verse, didn't it? I pray for you, all people, to behold my sorrow. So it's Jerusalem speaking, but it sounds almost like Jeremiah. But he's doing this personally. He's feeling this himself, but doing it this fashion, dramatically, to preserve the memory of the destruction of the city, all the details, for historical purposes. Just like Israel today is trying to perpetuate the memory of the Holocaust, which is proper, is a proper thing to do. But the younger generation, they're impressed when they go to the movie, but then afterwards they're back to their same lifestyle and they're not. There's no like conversion taking place. And the ones who make, I better stop. Behold, O Lord, for I am in distress, my bowels are troubled, my heart is turned within me. Now, when people get emotionally upset, sometimes the stomach is involved. You get loose bowels, for one thing. Running. And sometimes people, when they're emotionally disturbed, they can feel their heart flip-flop.
Yeah.
Like turn. And this has been described by people having this experience. And for I have grievously rebelled, abroad the sword bereaveth, at home there is as death. And so there's the reports outside, and then in the city itself, it's desolate. Death all around. It doesn't say the corpses are lying there, but that's true too. And they're left, they were not buried. So when the city was burned with fire and all, they didn't bother digging a mass grave even. Because what happened, they were taken captive. The enemy moved. But had the enemy wanted to occupy, well, then that's another matter. You get the bulldozers, the big pits, and put them in there so the odor won't be so obnoxious. You can't be fit to live there and might be liable to disease. No, it was prophesied, Jeremiah said, that you're not even going to be buried. Your children are even going to be killed and eaten for food. I mean, the most gruesome type of thing you could think of. So, we read at 21st verse. They have heard that I sigh. There is none to comfort me. All mine enemies have heard of my trouble, and they are glad that thou hast done it. Now, who were all the enemies?
Her lovers.
That's right. All her lovers are now turned out to be, in reality, enemies. Some with no support, and with some the opposite, encouraging the enemy. And the ones that should have been the closest were the ones that cheered the enemy on. The Egyptians, who were not as close, they were just did not give assistance. So we see these oddities happen where you expect the sometimes the most, the least is done. They have heard that I sigh. Now the thing is this. This is as though the city has just been destroyed. Just now. Now these ones that are doing all these things, they are now, this is the situation. The army just left with the cap, and this would include even the one who was left as, was it Gedaliah? Remember, he was left like a... But how long was he there? A very little, short time. And what happened? The ones who fled into the mountains and so forth, they came back to the city, and then they fled to Egypt. Yeah, they killed Gedaliah. That's right, the ones who came back. And that further aggravated the situation. But the city is now emptied. And this is just after... not only the destruction of the city and the temple, but the removal of Gedaliah. What was that, 5 months later or something, that happened? And so we find that this is the time frame, right after. Because what happens, we read the second part of the verse, thou wilt bring the day that thou hast called, and they shall be like unto me. Well, what about them? Yes.
The Lord had said that because of their either not coming to her aid or encouraging the enemy, even though the curse was upon Israel, despite that fact, that they would be made like Israel was shortly thereafter by the same army of Babylon.
Remember when Jeremiah made the yokes? And he sent out to the emissaries to the various nations. He sent the emissary back with a yoke and told them, warned them, of they would be taken captive. The only thing is we found that when Jeremiah came down to Riblah or Hamath, that now he came, which shall I do first? Which shall I destroy first? Jerusalem or Ammon and Moab? And he was inclined to go Ammon and Moab, but all the occult divination that they used said, go to Jerusalem. Just the opposite. So the Lord himself, by his providence, made the livers and other things to point, like the tea leaves, to point in the direction of Jerusalem. Contrary to his what felt would be the wiser method. So he went to Jerusalem. But the next... And they did not know that. They did not believe. So they're cheering them on, not realizing this has been forecast that they would be, and they were. And they shall be like unto me. And this is Jerusalem speaking. The city personified as a woman. It couldn't be more dramatic than this. And this is you. Disney, in his original pictures, he tried to lift the morals of the people, whether they realized it or not, when he was at the captain of the crew there, and tried to do it through animation of trees and animals speaking and things like that. Well, this is being done here, but it's done in a higher level as a woman with a higher sort of mentality, you know, but the same principle being used to teach lessons that are very needed. And now let's read verse 22 next.
Let all their wickedness come before thee, and do unto them as thou hast done unto me for all my transgressions. For my sighs are many, and my heart is faint.
All right. So that is obvious, just a carry-on from what the previous two verses. In the last study, we read that in Psalm 137, read that, which is very interesting, where it mentions about if I forget thee, and even by verses, by the rivers of Babylon, there we sat down, yea, we wept when we remembered Zion. Now this is a little later than what we're reading in Lamentations now, because we're like on the scene immediately after the devastation. This is now the captives who previously were taken into captivity before the city fell. Remember, there was a difference in chronology of 1 year, and people are always disputing why it says 18th and in another place it says a year different. And they think, well, what's the explanation? Well, the explanation is one went out about a year before, or part of a year, because when you're in a calendar year, it can be fractional, and they left earlier. So the word, there's not a discrepancy. It's a lack of understanding of the meaning for the difference of the 1 year mentioned. And what happens here, we hanged our harps upon the willows in the midst thereof, for there they that carried away us captive required of us a song. Now, Israel is well known for songs. Take the Jews in Russia. The way they sing and dance, it's sort of a clean, sort of happy, let's say all the males, they jump up and down and all. There's no intermingling. And their joy and their singing and doing acrobatics and so forth, they were known as being very skilled in singing, particularly. And Jewish cantors, some of them have extraordinary voices, and they avoid Hollywood where they could be top seed because their voices are so marvelous, because they are in the orthodoxy. And for them to go into the world, well, that's the last thing you should do. So they're known. Even now, when we were in Israel, the ones when from Romania, the Jews that came from there into Israel, their singing was so wonderful that even the local populace wanted to go to the service. It was packed. I went in part of a service just for about 10 minutes, and fortunately I got a seat, but it was crowded. So they're known for that. Then you had this a film, I didn't see it except on television, parts of it. What was it? On the Roof or something?
Fiddler
on the Roof, yeah. And in that, so there's a lot of capability there. So when they were in Babylon, they wanted them to sing, the Jews, because of the notoriety or the fame of their singing. Even Hitler, even in Germany, the ones who were good singers were spared, and they wanted them to sing, entertain them. This is during the Holocaust, so you can see there's this ability that they seem to have. And we do not see too much of it in our current life, because this is in the religious religious realm, that this capability and these dramas are visited and seen by Jews. And they have their own plays, their own dramas and so forth, but not many go except their own kind because of this communal spirit. Yes?
Well, Brother Frank, it's interesting here in verse 22 that even Jeremiah in his lamentation, like you said, personified as the city of Jerusalem, is going back to the prophecy that the Lord allowed him to give in saying that, okay, once the city is in ruins, but the Lord still will be working on your behalf in destroying your enemies. So here is still even this ray of hope that is going through with the prophecy that Jeremiah had given them years earlier.
It's a view. Depends whether you're the enemy not yet taken captive or the enemy that's already taken captive, because later on they shared the same fate. Let all their wickedness come before thee. Do unto them as thou hast done to my sighs, and many of my heart is faint. All right, this is first chapter. Yes.
Brother Frank, continuing on a little bit, in Psalm 137, it expresses the desire for the requiting, the retribution to come on the enemies. And the very last verse says, happy shall be he who takes your little ones and dashes them against the rocks. And wouldn't this be a clue that that's how Israel, some of Israel's children were treated, very brutally killed?
Yes. Yes, well, that's even in Jeremiah itself, but it's we had so many activity on. When we read the various verses earlier in Jeremiah, there's a lot more there that is overlooked because there's so much activity going on. All kinds of commotion. And when you're reading it, you can only absorb at one time a certain proportion. Our brains are not that sensitive to every nuance of that. But as you go over it, the verse, you'll say, oh yeah, that mentioned here, that two words there indicate that. And so we find that this is written for posterity. And it's interesting that what he wrote is still available. And we're reading it today. We're studying it today. Now we go into the next chapter. Let us read two verses. Next, please.
How hath the Lord covered the daughter of Zion with a cloud in his anger, and cast down from heaven unto the earth the beauty of Israel, and remembered not his footstool in the day of his anger. The Lord hath swallowed up all the habitations of Jacob, and hath not pitied. He hath thrown down in his wrath the strongholds of the daughter of Judah. He hath brought them down to the ground. He hath polluted the kingdom and the princes thereof.
Now he's taking a different stance. Instead of Jerusalem speaking, I, Jeremiah now is like taking the part of a disinterested, as it were, onlooker, who is just recording observations. Now, his emotions are not as apparent here when it was under the woman. He's looking and recording what he sees. And and he has cast down, he's now an observer. Instead of Jerusalem doing the talking and the showing of emotion, Jeremiah is now as an observer. Next chapter, he is right in the thing. It's him. He feels he is the one. How the Lord covered the daughter of Zion with a cloud in his anger. Well, don't we as Christians, if we have done anything wrong and we're trying to pray and contact the Lord through the name of Jesus, and a cloud may interfere, so we have to ask for forgiveness if anything done amiss. I'm saying on little things, but on dramatic things, I've heard testimonies of others that it was like talking to the wall here. And so you cannot get through. It cannot get through. So he's saying that instead of sunshine, the sunshine of God's favor and face on Jerusalem is cloud, dark, darkness over the land. So how hath Jehovah covered the daughter? Now it's the daughter of Zion. Still a woman, but he's observing. He's an observer now. And an accurate historian recording all the little details for a while. Yes?
Brother Frank, it brings out that point in chapter 3, verse 44. Thou hast covered thyself with a cloud that our prayer should not pass through.
Yeah. And that is Jeremiah's own experience for a while. But here it's the same principle as you're recording, only now it's he's observing as an outsider this cloud, and it's the cloud of his anger, of wrath. And he's cast down from heaven unto the earth the beauty of Israel. And when you level the temple, you're bringing it down to the earth. Bringing it down. So it becomes a symbol of being humbled and humiliated with this experience. And he remembered not his footstool in the day of his anger. Here we have a case of where it mentions the daughter of Zion being the footstool. So sometimes even the city is that, but more particularly the temple is the footstool, the actual communication in a more direct fashion comes from the temple mount. And so usually you'll have a few scriptures on the sanctuary being the footstool. Yes.
In Ezekiel it uses that kind of picture. Of course it seems a kingdom setting, but yes. In speaking to Israel, because normally I think a footstool as being the earth, but when you said about the more specifically, in Ezekiel 43:7, the Son of Man, the place of my throne and the place of the soles of my feet, where I will dwell in the midst of the children of Israel forever.
Yes. Yep. The soles of the feet is the footstool. Yes. I'm resting on the footstool. Yes, the earth is the footstool in Isaiah, etc. Too, in a larger sense. But the time period in which things are, the focus of attention is on, is the important, more important thing. But then, when you look at things in a very broad sense, and not localized, then the earth is his footstool, the whole planet. The Lord hath swallowed up all the inhabitants of Jacob and hath not pity. It's like a monster comes in and devours all the inhabitants of the city. But the Lord permitted this. He caused this to happen. And hath not pity. He hath thrown down in his wrath the strongholds of the daughter of Judah, and he hath brought them down to the ground. He hath polluted the kingdom and the princes thereof. Yes, well, that would be. Let us read 4 and. Three? All right. Wait, it's time to close. Right? You said 20 of them. So what we'll do, we'll start with what? Verse 3, God willing, in a future study. And then close this service with a word of prayer.